Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday morning. It is the first day of March, the third month of the year. Here we are already, and it is the first day, and we are thrilled that you are with us. It's a rainy gray day, and we hope that you are staying out of the rain. You are nice and dry and spending time with us. We would love to think that anyway, whether it's true or not. We also welcome you to write into the program if you have any thoughts on what we discussed this morning. We certainly welcome them. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And all we ask is that you keep them short and to the point and proofread them before you send them and send them to the right address. Those simple rules, and we'll be good to go. We have a great group this morning. Let me introduce everybody to you, beginning with WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. Under David Gustina's expert guidance, because he's our morning weather guy, I walked in the rain because I knew it was going to get windy in the afternoon. And we've been all right, except I stepped in a puddle.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my news for the day.
Got the shoe wet and the whole...
Shoes.
Yes,
and
okay.
Socks.
Well, dry off, get better.
Done already.
Good, good. UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, is with us. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning, everybody. I'm good. Glad to be here.
It's really a pleasure to have you today. Thank you very much for being with us. Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson, is here. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well.
Excellent. And we are thrilled that our dear friend Libby Post is here, political consultant, lobbyist, and has been with us for, since the beginning. And good morning, dear Libby. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. How are you?
Well, fine. You know, it was a busy news weekend and a lot to keep up, and certainly statewide was hard to keep up with it all. So we will do our best to do a recap and try to figure it out. That is our job here. So let us begin with the story that is the cloud over the city of Albany, besides the one that is dispensing the rain. Under siege over sex harassment claims, Cuomo offers apology, is the headline in today's New York Times. Governor Andrew Cuomo on Sunday sought to stem the growing political fallout over fresh allegations of sexual harassment, acknowledging that he may have made inappropriate remarks that, quote, could have been misinterpreted as an unwanted flirtation, end quote, to a young female aide during private meetings last spring. Mr. Cuomo said in his comments, including those which emerged in an account from the aide Charlotte Bennett, were an extension of life spent at work where he sometimes, quote, teased people about their personal lives and relationships, end quote. Mr. Cuomo said in a statement, quote, I now understand that my interactions may have been insensitive or too personal, and that some of my comments, given my position, made others feel in ways I never intended. The response from the governor seemed to reflect the gravity of Ms. Bennett's accusations and those of another former aide last week, as well as the potential damage that they could cause to Mr. Cuomo, a third-term Democrat. In a series of interviews with the New York Times last week, Ms. Bennett said Mr. Cuomo had asked her about elements of her sex life, including whether she practiced monogamy and had ever slept with older men. She also recounted that Mr. Cuomo told her that he was open to dating women in their 20s and spoke to her in discomforting ways about her own experiences with sexual assault. She said she believed the governor, who also complained of being lonely and wanting a girlfriend in Albany, was making sexual overtures toward her. With that said, we should say that both the governor and Ms. Bennett have said that the governor never inappropriately touched or, Mr. Cuomo in a statement said he never inappropriately touched or propositioned anyone. Ms. Bennett did not accuse the governor of touching her. So that is where it stands at the moment. Alan, I heard your commentary earlier, but I'm interested to hear in this elongated form of what you think.
That's good, Joe, because I don't remember what I said earlier.
Well, it was brilliant, so just keep it up.
Well, look, this is a very serious time for this governor, no question. As you know, he didn't talk to me for two terms, 8 years. And then all of a sudden, Ian Pickus came knocking on the door and said, the governor wants to talk to you. And then for a spate of several times, he did speak with us, and we had fun doing it. You know, he is a guy who has made a lot of enemies. He's a tough guy. I gave him a nickname a long time ago, Tough Guy Andrew. And that's what he does. He's tough on people. And now that he's in trouble, a lot of those people are using this as a good time to talk back to the governor. He stopped talking to us. We don't know why. We suspect the reason was that on two occasions I asked him two very simple questions. What are you doing for Thanksgiving? And his answer was, I'm bringing my mother up here. And, of course, that was something he had told everybody else not to do, and it made international headlines. And then the second one was the use of the N-word, in which he was trying to say that Italian Americans were once the ends of the society, and he used it thinking it wasn't a bad thing to do by making the comparison, and he got incredibly beat up for that. I think they decided not to talk to me anymore. It wasn't my fault. I just asked simple questions, and so he hasn't talked to us for months and months and months.
So, Libby, I guess I'm going to ask you the question that I just has kind of plagued me all weekend. But given what we have lived through as a nation and our coming to terms with Me Too and further understanding it, and I'm not naive enough to not know the answer to this, but I ask the question anyway, because you got to wonder what's going through a 63-year-old man's mind when he is alone in a room with a 25-year-old woman and starts talking about her sex life.
Well, I'm not going to presume to know the minutiae of what was on his mind. However,
well, I'm not even talking about motivation, but just knowing what we know of what the fallout could be, how do you do something so dumb?
Well, there is that. I mean, there's blood in the water, and the Republicans and even some Democrats are smelling blood in the water. You know, this could be the comeuppance for Cuomo that many people have been seeking for a very long time. What's so startling here, well, not really startling, but what's so evident here is, and I know I'll get in trouble for saying this, is male privilege. You know, it's like men think that they can do this without impunity. They think they can talk about sex with kids younger than his daughters, I think. And it's not just Cuomo, it's a lot of men feel like this is one of those things that, oh, I can joke around about this. I didn't touch her, so it's really not bad, you know, but without regard to how another person will take it. And it's specifically a young woman, who has had her own history of what it seems, because from what I read, she's had her own history of sexual trauma. You know, you can't, you have to be a little more human in terms of recognizing how words, not just action, but also words can impact somebody. You know, when I grew up, and I've thought about this a lot lately, you know, it was the adage of sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Well, that's just not true. And words do hurt. And I think men, especially powerful men, think they have privilege to be able to speak like this, act like this. We saw it with Clarence Thomas and the Anita Hill trials, the hearings. I don't know if he ever touched her, but he certainly made her feel uncomfortable. And men need to recognize that it's just not okay. And, you know, I'm disappointed because Cuomo, I was at the State of the State when he talked about Me Too and he introduced the woman who founded the movement and, you know, put in all the sexual harassment stuff into his administration and into state law and all of that. And then he does this, but I don't think he recognizes, like most powerful men, the impact of their words and their behavior, especially if it's, you know, it's a chat or it's not something that's constant or, right. Oh, I was just joking around, you know, it's very disappointing. It's very disheartening. Because look, Cuomo, we all know he's a bully. We get that. I know that. This is hardball politics and this is New York and we were all, you know, this is the mother's milk of politics is hardball in New York. And so it's very disappointing because his politics, the things he stands for, what he gets passed, the issues that I feel are important, like choice and LGBT rights and you know, social issues that are so important, he's on the correct side of. But then something like this happens, which can just totally bring down an administration. And it's a very delicate time right now. We're going into budget negotiations. There's all kinds of things on the table.
So, and Joe, yeah. If I may, really quickly, I'm hearing from all kinds of people. The reason that this is so dangerous for Cuomo is I'm hearing from all kinds of people about who the replacement would be. I've had calls about Tish James. I've had calls about Tom DiNapoli, who I love. I've had, you know, all of these people who are lining up. Kathy Hochul is making noises. The lieutenant governor, who was obviously chosen so that they would have that upstate, and female-male division. So, you know, it's a dangerous time for Cuomo.
I mean, if he resigns, Kathy Hochul becomes governor. It's just that simple.
Right. That's right.
But I don't think that's going to happen until the findings of the investigation are complete.
So, Sarah Rogerson, let me ask you a question about this isn't a legal question, although it could be. When the governor, which just the fact that he apologized for something made news enough, because that isn't really the governor's MO, but he did issue an apology on Sunday evening. And some are saying it's an apology of sorts, but it reads in part, I acknowledge some of the things I have said have been misinterpreted as an unwanted flirtation. To the extent anyone felt that way, I'm truly sorry about that. So what do those words mean to you?
It means that the governor needs to go to therapy. That's not an apology. Those are excuses. This is, somebody who hasn't sufficiently internalized the messages of the Me Too movement, even in spite of being a pretty incredible ally in lots of different ways in terms of getting state laws passed. And this is what happens when men and mm-hmm. men in power don't take the time because they're too busy, you know, being a bully to do a little bit of introspection, you know, to take the time to understand how their actions in these contexts in particular have to do with trust and consent and their violation of that. You know, I would like to think that we have a state government where young women who want to make our state better have a place to do that without having this kind of business in the governor's office. He's supposed to set the example and he hasn't done the work. He hasn't done the work to look inside of himself and say, you know, what things do I need to change about the way things have always been? And how can I be a leader on that front? And I'm sure he's done it in lots of other contexts. I've met him several times. I've watched him interact with women in completely unproblematic ways and encouraging ways. And it's what happens when no one's looking. That's the test of where your compass is on these issues. And it's obvious that he needs a bit more work. And it's a start of an apology. I really hope we don't have the first woman governor in the state of New York end up in that seat. And Kathy Hochul has done a lot to earn where she is. I'm not taking away from that. But for her to end up in this position of power on account of something like this is just difficult to piece through as a woman in New York who cares about leadership and the direction of our state.
So, Jennifer Burns, your thoughts on this?
I agree with what everyone is saying. But, you know, I was struck by a few things. And the first one was I clearly don't see what Cuomo said as an apology. That's it. That's, to me, it's dancing around the issue and being able to put yourself in the environment where the allegations were happening and then being able to control the narrative by saying it went a different way. Right. So it's sort of like admitting that, oh, yes, these conversations did happen, but they didn't go that way, to get himself off the hook. But the other thing is, you know, when he said, she told me in one of the reports I read, she told me about past experiences with sexual harassment. And that really stood out to me because I thought, why was that even happening?
Yeah. Well, and sexual abuse.
And that was, yes.
Why?
So why were those conversations even happening? And that makes me feel that he's trying to cover up his behavior because he knows these things happened. He was there. They were going on. And he can't all out lie and deny that they didn't happen because there's too much evidence and proof that they did. But I also am hesitant to fully convict him without this investigation. And I say that because there's more than just this going on, right? There's also the nursing home scandal.
Yeah.
There's the other thing that's unfolding, which is his intimidation and bullying and encouraging his staffers to do that to other people. I think the Times Union had a story run yesterday about staffers who had done that in the climate department with our own Judith Inc.
Right.
And then also, you know, lawmakers in general who want to pull back his powers.
Jennifer,
so there's multiple scandals.
I hate pausing you, but we just have to take a break. So I'm going to do this. When we come back, we'll immediately continue our discussion. We do welcome your thoughts on this as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Jennifer, we had a break there. Was there anything more you would like to say on that matter?
No.
Okay. then don't worry. We're going to keep talking. I have letters and we'll get back to your comments, I'm sure. Susan writes, choose your battles, and this isn't one of them. There is a devastating pandemic crippling our lives, and this is a ridiculous issue. Cuomo had done more good for this state than harm. It's ridiculous. That from Susan. Dare writes, Libya spot on. Though powerful men don't think they have privilege to harass women, they know they can, as our culture permits it, and protects them. This letter from Charlie. The second allegation against Cuomo has been largely reported as sexual harassment. Can the panel speak to whether or not a one-time incident like the one reported rises to the legal level of sexual harassment? I'm under the impression it requires either a sustained atmosphere or a really severe breach, and whether or not the legal definition matters in this case. Oh, Sarah Rogerson, please answer.
Well, it matters if somebody is bringing a civil lawsuit against the governor, which doesn't seem to be happening at this point in time. Harassment generally of any kind typically requires the establishment of a pattern of practice. But the more that time passes, the more these types of patterns emerge. It's not at all the same, but that's how cases like the original Me Too, Harvey Weinstein movement built, was over time. You know, as more women came forward. So it's a little bit of time will tell. Right now, what's being discussed is an investigation, and it's independent of the civil or criminal justice system until a complaint is filed in civil court or a criminal complaint is filed. So at this point, it really is more of an investigation, and these are allegations. You know, it may be premature to be talking about whether or not anyone could force the governor out of office as a result. But certainly he's going to have a lot to think about over the next several weeks and months about whether or not it's appropriate for him to continue to be in that position and voluntarily whether he will leave the office.
The letter writer used the word sustained harassment. And in the case of this woman, though, it was not a one-time incident, right, Libby? I mean, it was over several, it was over a period of time.
I only know what was in the Times article, and it seemed like it was a number of conversations. It made her uncomfortable enough to tell people about it. She told her mom, she told friends, which, you know, then is a record of what happened.
Well, and she reported it to two officials and was reassigned to a job. She decided not to go forward with a formal complaint because she felt better in the job, although she did leave that job a short time later and moved out of the state.
You know, I it's just, it's very, very disappointing. You know, what time will tell to see if there's going to be other women who move, come forward. That's going to be the linchpin here.
All right. More letters. We go to Joan, who says, not excusing anything, but how does Cuomo's alleged behavior tie into how often and how publicly in the past year the media and others were presenting him as being sought after by so many women, and it seemed that no one decried this as out of bounds?
I guess I'm confused.
He was the sexy political hunk. There was whole Cuomo sexual thing. There was all that.
Well, look, I mean, we are a superficial culture. We have the most beautiful men or the most handsome men on Time Magazine or People Magazine or whatever that is. But we also have women who actively pursue incarcerated mass murderers and find them attractive. So that's, I guess, that wasn't nice of me to say, but that's what goes on in America.
Not untrue, but yes. Lynn says, yeah, I think, go ahead.
I would just add, I think that it's inappropriate either way. You know, I felt very uncomfortable when I saw state and local elected officials, mostly local, sort of engaging in that behavior around the governor and his popularity during the pandemic. And if you want to talk about distracting, I would say that that's more distracting behavior to really, you know, be focusing on leaders' appearance. As women, if we're going to ask to be in a safe work environment, it doesn't, you know, when the shoe's on the other foot, it doesn't make it any better.
Let's go to some more letters on this particular topic. Jones is not excusing any. I think I just answered that. I'm sorry. Let's go to Judy. I'm sorry. There we go. Judy says, I just have an observation regarding Cuomo's alleged inappropriate behavior with a woman who is about the age of his daughters. I wonder how he would feel if other men in power approached his daughter in the same way. Phyllis says, trainings at work to learn workplace appropriate behavior. He needs it. Time out for bad behavior. John says, having listened to Governor Cuomo for a year now during his briefings, we should all have a sense of how well he can tell jokes. If we measured ability to tell jokes on a scale of 0 to 100, where, say, Lucille Ball is 100, Andrew Cuomo is a -3, someone should have told him a long time ago that he can't tell jokes, and especially to never joke about certain things. Well, that assumes that they were jokes and not meant the way that many people would take them. I think the governor is trying to make them sound like they were jokes, but that is different.
Well, it is a way of deflecting and saying, oh, I wasn't being serious. Oh, it was just a joke. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just joking around without any regard to the impact.
Charlie says, the second allegation against Cuomo has been largely reported. I did that one, too. I'm bad on collating today. Richard says, while the left is occupied with policing the verbal purity of aging white male politicians, the Republican Party is engaged in a massive ground game to drive black people out of our electoral democracy state by state. The folly of the Democratic left always astounds me. Jennifer, would you like to address that one?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the double standards here that are happening to Democrats doing the right thing and demanding answers on this situation with Cuomo. But also, you know, we've just gone through 4 years of President Trump doing all this joking and saying what he did. And remember, he had sexual allegations. He's had all kind of allegations and continues to get away with it. And so we are working on, you know, double standards of racism, double standards of sexism. And I'm struck by how much of these multiple different strands of scandal with Cuomo are coming out, because it reminds me of Hillary Clinton's comment about Bill Clinton, that this was a right-wing kind of conspiracy against Bill, right? Mm-hmm. With the Monica Lewinsky case. And I don't know what to do with that yet, because it's all unfolding in the last couple of days, really. But there's something political weaponizing and also racist and sexist being coalesced with a deeply Republican tone that I feel Democrats are falling for.
Well, one of the first things that came to my mind is, has the Republicans gotten to some of these women? I mean, I hate to say it that way, but from a political point of view, it was one of the first things that came to my mind is who, you know, who's pushing these women. Well, this one particular woman, to do this, are the Republicans behind it? Nick Langworthy is Trumpian and is somebody like Trump who will accuse others of what they do themselves. And so this is a great setup for Cuomo. I'm not excusing anything, but from a purely political point of view, when you look at the hardcore politics of New York State, this can be quite the setup of undermining Cuomo to the point where he may have to resign or he doesn't run again. Not that the Republicans are ever going to be elected statewide in this state again, because the numbers just aren't there. And you'd have to have a real Rockefeller Republican, somebody who's pro-choice, pro-gay rights, in order for that to happen.
Well, this
But, you know, it's there is this, something smacks of all of this.
This circles back to what you were saying, Alan, right? That yeah. It gives the opportunity for many people who have been wronged by this governor, quote unquote, both Republican and Democrats to take the shot.
I think that's absolutely true. You know, I call him Tough Guy Andrew. He is a tough guy with a lot of people. And when you examine the role of who his friends are, you know, who are the friends of Andrew Cuomo, you're not going to come up big. I'll tell you right now, he doesn't have that many obvious political friends or otherwise. So I think some of this can be ascribed to him by, you know, if you're tough with other people, when they get their shot, believe me, I understand this, they're going to come back at you.
So let's see. We have a couple. I'll read one or two more letters, then we'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll finish these up. Richard says, all right, I'm repeating these and I have to figure out why I'm doing that. But okay. Lynn says, I'm now 56. I don't deal with this as much, but it was so exhausting being a woman anywhere you went when I was younger. And that meant in any work environment or any situation where you might find yourself alone with a man. It happens so frequently, but like your panelist said, it's very disappointing coming from somebody who represented himself as being on the correct side of issues. We then go to Jim. There is no defense for Cuomo's actions, but why is Libby describing this in terms that apply generally to men? I'm a male sexual abuse survivor who, in a 30-year career, has been sexually harassed by three different female supervisors. Where do people like me fit into Libby's one-dimensional narrative? Libby.
I don't want to deny the fact that there are women who act inappropriately as well. And from my perspective, they see power from a very male way of looking at things. And I don't want to deny anybody's reality and experience of being sexually harassed. However, the overwhelming majority of sexual harassment is men towards women. And we cannot deny that either. So I'm sorry if I hurt anybody's feelings or denied anybody's reality. I don't want to do that. But I'm a woman. I've been harassed, not in the last 20 to 30 years. You know, it's very interesting when you're an out lesbian, you can either be really harassed or people are afraid of you. And I'd rather take the latter, and I think that that's the case. So I have not been sexually harassed in a very long time. But the majority of harassment is male on female, and we cannot deny that. And it is a societal problem.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many letters, and we'll finish up with those, and then we'll move on to other topics. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson, all part of the program this morning. Again, we welcome you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Again, Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson make up the group. Alan, I want to get to more of these letters. I do want to ask you a question that such investigations, there was a whole hoorah around who would be doing the investigation this weekend. And we seem to have now settled this with the Attorney General. So divorcing it of who the players are here for a moment, how do these investigations usually unfold, and are we expecting something that is going to happen quickly, or is this going to be something that is going to take a long time?
You know, Joe, it depends. You know, it depends on the character of the people who are doing the investigations, or the motivations of the people who are doing the investigations. You know, in New York State, we say, AG, it's a joke. But as Freud once said, there is no joke, or is alleged to have said anyway, because AG means almost governor. And in the last, Cuomo was an AG, Spitzer was an AG. We do know that this is a traditional jumping off place. Now, when a lot of eyebrows went up when Letitia James came out with what was a very tough report on Cuomo and the nursing home supposed, in quotes, scandal. You know, how many people got the disease? Did they get it in the hospital? Did they get it out of the hospital? And a lot of people said, whoa. And we all know that Cuomo was a fan of Letitia James. So now it's being thrown to Letitia James to do the investigation, or to find somebody who is going to do the investigation. So a lot is going to have to do with who the people are who are doing the investigating. I guess that's as far as I'm going on this.
Yeah. Sarah, anything you'd like to add about that, as of how this was handled over the weekend? Because originally the governor was saying, oh, I know somebody who could do it.
Yeah, the Attorney General was pretty unequivocal about her position on that. And we have to hold each other accountable. We, people who identify as Democrats, have to hold each other accountable. And, you know, when you don't have a strong enough Republican Party to check that balance, and when you're in a state where we can make a lot of progress, somebody has, you know, there has to be this is the role of the Attorney General, right? It's checks and balances. It's making sure that, you know, the reason why we have it set up that the governor gets to make these decisions in these situations is ridiculous to begin with. You know, who's gonna call for an investigation on themselves? But these are larger governance issues that can and should be tackled by future legislators.
Now, Sarah, what about? Let me try a different one on you. Suppose it was the Attorney General, male or female, who had said something inappropriate, done something inappropriate. Who would do the investigation then?
That's a great question. I would imagine that the governor's office would be interested in setting up some sort of independent investigatory unit somehow. Maybe through the Solicitor General's office or another office in state government.
But, you know, your point was very well taken about you know, these circumstances. And these are tough times, which I think come down to the character of the people who are being investigated. I also think Cuomo has brought some of this on himself by being so tough on everybody else. Who knows?
Erica writes to us and says, Andrew, 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 gone are the days of the I didn't know my comments would be interpreted as blah, blah, blah. Me Too has been going on for at least 5 years in the headlines. Fire your PR team and shut the hell up. All the attention clearly went to his head and he started to believe the hype. If it's not about the job, don't say it. I still think he did a good job in other areas. That from Erica. John says, how should someone express personal interest in another person without venturing into the realms of harassment? Well, if they work for you, you shouldn't, right?
Don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Don't do that. Yeah, you can do it. There are many, 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 many different ways to get people's attention without getting, you know, making work a fertile ground for, you know, your dating life.
Alan, this one's for you. John says, I think it'd be a good idea to tap Preet Bharara for the job. He seems to be the best person for it.
He'd be great. I have great faith in Preet Bharara. And you know that when Cuomo's pals ended up in jail, who were at top level, Preet Bharara came forward and said, but the governor didn't know about this. So he does have his spurs in terms of, you know, we can assume that he can be fair.
Libby, anything on that?
I think Preet Bharara would be good. I mean, I know that Tish James is going to strive to be independent, and I hope that, that's the case. You know, people pushed back on Janet Fiore and other people, but we have to remember that the governor also tapped Tish James to be attorney general. And so I'm just hoping that there's enough, you know, fortitude within the office to make sure it's independent. And, you know, finding, you know, doing a special prosecutor kind of thing with Preet Bharara or somebody of his caliber might be the best way to go and take it out of the politics.
And exactly. And the reason for that is Preet Bharara doesn't have anything to gain on this. You know, even Letitia James will be, you know, almost governor, as I said before, AG. You know, she would be, she might be suspect. So that's why she should do it. And she should find somebody who people really trust.
All right, let's go to this letter from Jeff, who says, men at heart are sexual predators. It's biologically wired in. Men were designed to spread their seed as far and wide as possible. This letter already is making me uncomfortable. Women can only give birth once every 9 months. It's a hardwired survival strategy. Unless men are taught properly when they are young, this behavior will never be extinguished. Well, I think it is possible, as I believe Libby famously on this program once said, keep it in your pants, right?
Well, and but above and beyond that, raise our sons well and to respect women and to not assume anything.
Kippy writes to us and says, just stop it. They didn't have the wherewithal to speak to the offender. Hey, governor, knock it off. Governor, you're making me uncomfortable. Governor, tisk, tisk, watch yourself. Why didn't they say anything?
Because one of them is 23, 24 years old. And it's quite the power trip when, you know, you've got a however old. 63-year-old.
And the governor of the state and her boss.
Right, right, right. And it's not about whether it was Cuomo or anybody else. It's the governor. And it's a powerful position.
And I also would say to that letter, which I find disturbing, but what I would also say to that letter is that she followed protocol. She did go to her supervisor and reported it. She then gave a report to another official within the administration a month later. So she went through the proper channels. It was reported. She did say something. She did without having to confront the quote-unquote offender. I think I have time for two more letters, and then we'll go to the top of the break. Colleen says, just an observation, this can be a teaching moment. The sex life of young women occupies entirely too much space in the brains of quote-unquote older men. It's not just Cuomo. And Lynn says, my father, who passed in 2007, used to say a similar thing regarding the way Italians were treated when they arrived here in the late 19th century and early 20th. It broke his heart to be a super successful businessman yet not accepted by the upper class WASPs. I think Cuomo's daughters will take him to task for his poor decisions, and this is his moment to learn and grow. I'm sorry, he was stellar during the early days of the pandemic. This has all been very disturbing to me. That from Lynn. We'll pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics. We welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Next up on the Hit Parade, we'll talk about CPAC and what transpired over the weekend. We welcome your thoughts. We'll be right back after this. All right, I know I said I was going to move on. There's just this one letter that tickled me that I want to read. this is from Jason, who says, good morning, panel. I do not know why this always happens, but it always happens. At the beginning of the pandemic, Cuomo was hailed as a champion of truth and held us as a shining example of leadership by the media. So stick with me here, says Jason. Hootie and the Blowfish were hailed in the mid-90s as the greatest rock and roll band of the decade by the media. At decade's end, Hootie and the Blowfish became a joke, a meme for Much Ado About Nothing again by the media. Now Cuomo is being reviled for his language and behavior. May I suggest that, like Hootie and the Blowfish, Andrew Cuomo was neither as good as he was made out to be by the media, nor as bad as he is being made out to be by the same media. And that from Jason. All right, let's go to other topics. And as I mentioned, we will address CPAC. Trump was there yesterday, the former president in Orlando, Florida, declaring Sunday that he is considering a presidential run in 2024, has ruled out forming a third party, and will devote himself to building up Republican efforts to take on Democrats and others he claimed have targeted his movement. This from the Washington Post. The address before the crowd of the Conservative Political Action Conference marked Trump's first political speech since leaving the White House. It was staged as a public declaration of Trump's intention to play a dominant political role in controlling the GOP through the 2022 election and to potentially set himself up for a third campaign for the White House. We began it together 4 years ago, and it is far from being over, Trump said of the political journey launched by his 2016 campaign. Let there be no doubt that we will be victorious and America will be stronger and greater than ever before. Alan, your thoughts.
This guy, Trump, may be the most dangerous person that has ever been president of the United States. He was leading us into fascism. He was leading us to undo the Constitution of the United States. And he is an evil and mean-spirited man, period. Now, with all of that said, I can tell you that a lot is going to depend on how Joe Biden plays this. Because if Biden, who won because he was a moderate, continues to lean left, but not be extraordinarily left, he will win again. If the uber left pulls him over to the side where those people who voted, those 7 million people who voted for him, and I'm assuming that's who they were, now give it up, and those 7 million people say, these Democrats are always the same, they're disgusting. I don't think they are. I'm for every one of those left-wing positions. I'm for health care. I'm for all of that stuff. But I think the most dangerous thing in the world is to let Trump come back and be the president of the United States.
Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah, what a nightmare. I agree 100%. I do prefer to hear his quotes read by you, Joe, if you can just,
you need the cadence.
No, because I was like, yeah, you know, so I don't have to read his tweets. I don't have to listen to him on the radio. I don't have to hear his voice constantly. I don't have to defend our clients to his oppressive and just racist and awful immigration policies, right? But he's not done with us yet. He's not going quietly. I think what was clear to me, and he has enablers and people who are willing to repeat what he says for personal gain, not just to quote the news. And I'm trying to hold faith in the part of the justice system that's tasked with investigating him, right? The Supreme Court ruled that his finances have to be released. We'll see as those records make their way through the system. I really feel like we need it. I would never say this in ordinary times, right, about a Democratic leader, quote unquote. But I feel like because of the things that he's done, there's a good chance that the only way that we'll be protected from him in the future is if he is in jail.
And by the way, Hitler, as you know, and Stalin, they had their followers, the same people, the same type of people. I'm not saying the same people who were, you know, yelling and screaming for him yesterday, unthinking, not understanding what the implications of what they're doing are. And that is something that is so scary, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, Libby, this struck me too as reading this article about Trump and having tuned into various parts of the conference over the weekend. I mean, Trump certainly was not the scariest person speaking at CPAC over the weekend.
Well, I have to say I did not tune in. You know, I had other things to do, and as I said to Lynn last night after we watched the national news, it was so nice not hearing him. Seeing him for the last month or so, you know, it really has been very, very nice. No, what scared me, I mean, a lot of these people are scary. The golden image of him that was wheeled through the hall, you know, God told us, you know, not to bow down before graven images, and they're bowing down before an orange image. Making him into some kind of god. And the other thing that I found fascinating was the design of the stage was, from all accounts and everything that I've read, yes, sort of an old Druin design, but it was a design that was embraced by the Nazi Party. And you can't tell me that this wasn't deliberate. Not that the majority of people there would even know, but it's one more message to those who understand what's going on that we will be targets if these people get back in power.
So, Libby, could you describe for a few of us who really didn't notice what you were saying, what that looked like?
Yeah, hold on. I'm just going to bring it
up. Well, I have it here. The Hyatt Hotels Corporation called symbols of hate abhorrent on Sunday after the design of a stage at the right-wing Conservative Political Action Conference at one of its hotels drew comparisons to a Norse rune used by Nazis during the Second World War. Right. High-profile Republicans, including former President Donald Trump, were attending the four-day event in Orlando. A photo of the CPAC stage went viral on social media on Saturday, with thousands of Twitter users sharing posts comparing its distinctive design to an Athala rune, also known as an Odal rune, I hope I'm pronouncing that correct, one of the many ancient European symbols that Nazis adopted to reconstruct a mythic Aryan past, according to the Anti-Defamation League. And so the ceiling of the conference room featured a lighting display in the same shape as the stage, according to the photographs. Hyatt said all aspects of the conference logistics, including the stage design, were managed by the American Conservative Union, which organized the conference. Meanwhile, the chair of the American Conservative Union said that the comparisons were, quote, outrageous and slanderous.
Okay. Where'd you get the design from? Who did it for you? Who was your stage set person? I'd like to know.
Not only
what
that,
are their politics?
Not only that, you remember in the beginning they were showing clips of the people who were kicking it off, the chair of the Conservative Union,
saying everybody should wear a mask because that's the policy of the people who are running this hotel, and they got almost booed off the stage.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me go to Jennifer here. We have not heard from you yet on this particular subject.
Well, when it comes to the stage design, I think it's the perfect opportunity to talk about implicit bias, where people are unconscious of the bias that they have. They don't always realize. Now, some people are purposeful. They are hateful. They're doing it on purpose to send a message to others who are aware of this symbol. But we have to begin to examine the racism and anti-Semitism that some of us have internally that we don't realize we have. And then we demonstrate by presenting symbols like this that perhaps wasn't intentional to do, but it's in you and it's coming forth culturally. Mm-hmm. The other thing, you know, one, this event was a total super spreader. So we should add that in there. And lastly, I think what I found the most profound was how well Trump actually did in his Trumpian way. And I'm saying that not as a Trump person at all, because I'm totally not. But he, more than usual or in the past, focused on policy, and he did it in his regular way, which is always often kind of crooked and confusing, more than many of the other politicians that were there. He was going after immigration in his way. He was singling out those Republicans in name only, right? The rhinos, to entice his base, but then also to get that middle chunk of wavering Republicans over in unity with some of his base, right? Get rid of the swamp people, get rid of, you know, some of these other guys who really aren't on your side. I didn't watch the whole thing. I ended up watching parts and then reading it because, you know, there's too much work when you're watching Trump. It's all over the place. But scarily, like Alan said, he mastered this well. And that is very, very frightening. And Americans should be afraid if they're not picking up on how subtly he is making sure that his base is being attached and gaining power in the Republican Party.
Alan, anything to add to that?
Yeah, well, what is interesting is that his numbers for people who want him to run for president are fairly low. They're in the 60s, I believe, low 60s. So it is interesting. This is and that, I'm sorry, was from a poll of the people who were at the conservative conference. So that has to tell you something. You know, I can only hope that that people come to their senses while Biden is the president and realize that what they were afraid of isn't happening. And you all know what that means, which is that people of color, people of Hispanics, people who are poor aren't taking over their country and forcing them to basically lose it. And I think that's why I think Biden was a brilliant pick for the Democrats.
Except that these people will believe that regardless of reality.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
His base will believe that people of color, Jews, lesbians and gays, bisexual, transgender, anybody who's not white and straight are coming for them and are taking over the country. You know, I do think that there are some folks within his past voting bloc from 2016 who are absolutely disgusted and would never vote for him again. And January 6th, you know, set that in stone. But I still think his base still believes that everyone's coming for them.
The question, Libby, is how big is his base?
I think it's 25 to 30% of the electorate.
You know, I know a lot of Republicans who hate this guy's guts, and we see it all the time. So if that number is going down, that means, you know, there's a part of me that's, oh boy, I mean, I shouldn't even say this out loud, but there's a part of me that thinks
the Democrats are better off if Trump is the candidate, because after all, he lost by 7 million votes the last time out, and he is seen as a very dangerous man by a lot of people, including a lot of Republicans. I don't see how he wins that election. And by the way, he may be in jail.
And that's clear. I mean, he can't win an election without these moderate middle just based on his base. That's he can't right. win the election. That's so that's, right. I think, why he's working so hard to get some of these, what he sees as those, you know, Republican name only, more of the conservative, not his camp people, the middle group there, on to stay united with his base, or to at least embrace his base.
And yet he's going after them. He's going after them by name.
Yeah.
The Liz Cheney's and everybody else, the Bushites, in other words, the people who... Yeah, please.
He thinks that that's what will work. It's the whole bully thing. And he just thinks that that's what's going to work. And he'll get more people on his side. But honestly, he's going to start a super PAC. He's going to raise millions of dollars. It's all going to go into his pocket. You know, it's all going to go to his legal defense. None of this is going to be used for political purposes, I don't think.
Well, as Marketplace pointed out, since the day the voting stopped in this country, this president has been raking in the money. I mean, that has been former president now.
But he's also rigging the elections so that you now see in Georgia, for example,
right.
and other places, there's the legislature, the Republican legislature, who beckoned to his call, if that's the right word, are doing things like... trying to eliminate, mail voting.
Right.
Right.
And right. Yep.
Talk about rigging.
You know, we really need the Federal Election Commission to start an investigation into how these funds are being used, because
and they ought to do it now.
The amount of time it will take to do that investigation, by the time we find out what he's done, it'll be too late.
I want to go to another topic before we have our break at the bottom of the hour. Immigration advocates and experts across the political spectrum do not expect the comprehensive immigration bill backed by President Joe Biden to pass in Congress as is, but the areas where the priorities align highlight opportunities for bipartisan compromise. Democrats on February 18th introduced the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021, which would establish an 8-year path to citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants, broaden legal immigration avenues, and reduce visa backlogs, among other provisions. Even upon introduction, the bill's sponsors acknowledged the possibility of an alternative piece-by-piece approach to passing immigration reform. So the areas here, the areas where their priorities align highlight opportunities for bipartisan compromise. Potential contenders for piecemeal reform include establishing a path to citizenship for Dreamers, reforming the agricultural worker program, and expanding employment-based immigration. So we go to our immigration expert, the director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson. Your thoughts on this?
Well, it's always right. So the pragmatist in me is like, of course, you know, you have to say that there may be that compromise is inevitable. I truly, desperately, pretty dramatically hope that we don't end up in a piecemeal situation where we're privileging, and I give it to all the organizers and list them up who were able to get the DACA movement underway and the Dreamers in this country. And this is not to take away from them, but we have to stop privileging model immigrants in this country to say, if you do all the things that our children can't do, that we're taking out on you, then you can become citizens of this great country. It's just disheartening to hear certain, you know, or employment-based groups. You know, immigrants add a lot to the fabric of our society as a nation of immigrants. In the realms of art and culture and just human relationships, friends, neighbors, people we rely on, like there should not be this. If you can bring in some money to this country, if you have never made a mistake in your life, if you Even if you've been here for 11 years and we've seen the record of your life paying taxes, maybe something might stand out that will make us decide that you're not good enough to be here. None of us hold ourselves to the standards that we hold immigrants in this country. And it's really disheartening to hear already sort of what I'm seeing as troubling sort of cracks in the armor when we really had this administration starting out very strong on immigration. They also backpedaled the deportation moratorium that was supposed to be in place for the first 100 days. When this issue is pulling so strongly across multiple different sectors across the entire United States of America, why we end up having these so frustrating conversations in Washington, D.C. is beyond me. I guess it's not. You know, we've lost our moral compass. We don't have the conversations that we need to be having. The Poor People's Campaign work still has a lot to do under this administration. But, you know, it's not that hard. It really isn't. And I know we need 10 Republicans to get a filibuster-proof majority, but I just worry a lot about how much will be sacrificed,
Sarah,
in this round. And I will be thankful for anything we get, to be clear.
Sarah, let me take the con on this one, just for the heck of arguing it and trying to get it straighter in my mind. I'm assuming that the president of the United, current president of the United States, is doing everything in his power, Joe Biden, to figure out how to get reelected the next time and not let Trump back in. Would you go along with that so far? It's a trick question, so I don't.
No, yeah, I'm not, because I know where you're going with it, and this is part of the problem.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is, okay. Now, we have to assume Donald Trump, who was always against the other, we know that, was doing his own polling, and they were coming up with the fact that people were yelling, disgustingly so, shut the doors, don't let him in, bring up the gangplank. I'm assuming that that's what they were finding. Therefore, Trump thinks that this is a great way to bring some people over to his side of things.
It's not a good assumption, though. It didn't work. It didn't do that thing. Racism worked. You know,
What makes you think
because
it didn't work?
The polls, if you look at polls on immigration, the polls did not back up his claims that this was a moving issue for people to get to mm-hmm. for people to get out the vote. It was not something, and I cannot tell you how many Trump supporters I know, which is a hard thing to say to begin with, who reached out to
your family.
It's not just my family. There are other people who reached out to me and said, help us with immigration. Help us with this, with our neighbor. You know, like, it's just not there. He is trying. That's one of his strongest narratives.
So I get it, and I'm sorry for interrupting, but so let me ask you this. So why is Biden pulling back, as you suggest? Is it because he's not politically aware of what the risks are here?
No, I think there's so much that they're finding out. When he initially, within the first week of some of the things that he did, there were certain officers within the Department of Homeland Security, some of them pretty high ranking, who said that they were going to, you know, stage a coup and basically ignore what he wanted them to do. And, you know, that's not helpful, right? So some of it may be trying to get all of his players on board and make sure that his team is able to do all of the things that they need to do and not have, internal resistance, which I understand. Maybe it's a go slow approach. We also have elected officials who are now trying to undo the damage that Trump did in terms of backpedaling the idea that immigrants are dangerous. Whether or not people would oppose a pathway to citizenship for their church members is different than how they feel about locking up people alleged to have committed DWIs, right? Mm. People have very dramatically different issues on immigration once you get down to the nitty gritty. And some of the things he was doing in the beginning, you know, I got to hand it to him. Burke's detention facility in Pennsylvania is empty. And I'm not handing it to the administration. I'm handing it to the attorneys who have been fighting for years to get those women, young people out of that detention facility. So a lot of good is happening. It's just, you have to be careful.
All right.
It's surgical at this point.
We have to pause because it's our final break here as we go into our last segment together as part of the panel this morning. We'll take a break. We'll be back. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Our last segment together for the Roundtable panel this morning, Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. Before I move on, we have some letters here on Trump and CPAC, but I wanted to check in with Libby and Jennifer to see if either of you want to comment on immigration before we move on completely.
No, I'll leave it to Sarah. She's the expert.
Okay.
Me too.
All right. With the time deferred to Sarah, Sarah, if you want to say something else, let me know. Okay. So Jean says, what happened in America that allowed the dumbing down of people was allowed to become so prevalent? Oh, well, how many times have we asked ourselves that question over the last several years? Darren says, don't be sure that Trump can't win again. His henchmen are beginning to suppress the vote in state legislatures as you speak, a point Alan raised just moments ago. Keith says, don't give CPAC and the GOP the benefit of the doubt. We see them all the time in photos accidentally flashing the white power sign. I'm tired of their quote-unquote unintentional racism and bigotry. It is time to cancel them.
Hear, hear.
Dixie says, am I the only one who thinks Trump will be too mired in legal problems to run for and or serve as president? Well, you were hinting to that earlier, Alan, right?
We can only hope. But
he came into the position mired in lawsuits. You know, didn't seem to stop him.
That's right.
Let's see. We go to John, who says, as soon as I saw the gold-colored Trump idol, I immediately thought of the old Bob's Big Boy statue and then of the inflatable rats one sees in New York City. We go to Harris, who says, to appreciate the sophisticated extent of the right-wing propaganda, listen to South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem's CPAC speech. She bragged about how she kept businesses and schools open, how she rejected mask mandates, and how wrong Dr. Fauci was. What she conveniently left out of her speech was the fact that South Dakota had the second highest per capita rate of COVID infection and the seventh highest per capita COVID-related death rate in America. The propagandists are incredibly adept at just reporting the alternative facts, and their base continues to swallow that Kool-Aid. That from Harris. All right, let's move on to another subject here as we wind up this morning and just have about 10 minutes or so left. We talk about ultimately two anniversaries today. One anniversary is that it is the one-year anniversary of the first case of COVID reported in New York State. So this is day 365 here. The other is that it is also a year after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. His death has sparked a bipartisan effort to remake the state's 158-year-old citizens' arrest law, but a potentially divisive trial awaits. This is from Waynesboro, Georgia. Scores of mourners gathered last week at a rural cemetery for a service to mark the first anniversary of the slaying of Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old black man who was chased by a trio of white men and shot to death in a residential street. Mr. Arbery's killing on a sunny afternoon in a suburban South Georgia neighborhood drew widespread outrage when it happened, particularly with its evocation of the tortured racial history in the South, and together with the subsequent police killings of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, his death has contributed to the national furor over shooting deaths of black people and the wave of protest against systemic racism. Meanwhile, but the mourners are also steeling themselves for the possibility of more painful moments in the months to come, including a potentially explosive murder trial for the three men. They have been in jail since their arrest on murder, assault, and other charges. If convicted, each faces life in prison without parole. We are not seeking revenge. We are seeking justice, as a minister in Waynesboro, the hometown of Mr. Aubrey's mother. Justice is what is right in the eyes of the Lord. His supporters have found allies far beyond the world of liberal activists. They include Governor Brian Kemp, a conservative Republican who has been accused by liberals of supporting voter suppression tactics that target African Americans, and who, as a candidate in 2018, suggested in a campaign ad that he might take vigilante action against undocumented immigrants. So a whole lot of stuff to unpack in that. Let me go to you first, Jennifer, and get your thoughts.
Well, the fact that it is becoming so difficult for people to come behind the fact that these three men caught on video doing what they did, which is to murder Ahmaud Arbery, is being so roiled and twisted in a way where it wasn't a racist act right off the bat is a problem, because that's exactly what it was. There's no other explanation for this. The two McMichaels, the son and the father, who was a former county police officer, and his friend who followed them in a car and videotaped this whole thing, then not wanting filing petitions to not use the word victim when people are talking about Ahmaud Arbery. That's exactly what this young man was. He is a victim to their vigilante-ness and their racism. And it's on the streets in Georgia, and it's on the streets in other parts of the country. And I think Kemp, as a Republican, and many other Republicans in that state, are looking at a way to try to do a little something that's not really enough to address the racism in the state, but to try to win back some Black voters because of the shift in Georgia, with Ralph Warnock elected, Ossoff elected, and watching Stacey Abrams be able to maneuver that state in a more democratic way and a way to fight systemic racism there.
Mm. Well said. Libby Post.
You know, when what Jennifer was just saying about Warnock and Stacey Abrams and, you know, the progress that we're making in Georgia, this is exactly why Trump's people think we're taking their country away from them. And I'm not saying that, and I am all for it, but just making the point here that, you know, any bit of progress by folks who aren't white and straight, and conservative, and I will say Christian as well, you know, is seen as a threat. And when I read this story this morning, I was just disgusted by this notion that you can't call this man a victim, and wanting to use his prior, you know, issues, criminal issues, his history, and he has a mental illness. I mean, they want to use it against him, but they don't want the prosecutors to be able to use all the tools in their toolbox, you know, and the whole notion of this citizen's arrest. This guy was gunned down. Let's be honest. He was murdered. And I'm afraid that these three white guys in this particular area of Georgia might well get off as white men who have killed people of color for as long as this country has been around. Have always gotten off for the most part. Look at, you know, the police who have routinely killed Black men in their custody, and many of them have gotten off. You know, so when people are afraid that, you know, we're taking over their country, all you need to do is look at the judicial system and some of these decisions. If the prosecutors were smart, they'd ask for a change of venue. And take it out of that area and put it somewhere else, like in Atlanta, where at least you'd have a chance at a balanced jury.
Well, the other problem with this is the prosecutorial problems in the past with people who have had to either resign or recuse themselves, and the delay in even arresting these three men or even questioning these three men in the incident. Because not until the video came out, so we had, what, over a month before the video even came out, were they arrested or were they, you know, brought into custody? And then you have the criminal justice system component of it that is showing some real corruption we want to make, I would say, we want to make sure that we're looking at two separate things here, because the McMichaels and Brian are just people. I don't want to say just people, but they're other citizens, just like when we walk down the street and we run into people at the coffee shop. That's what they are. So they did this act. And then you have a separate, which is that systemic component of, you know, the DAs and others, right, who are then involved in here. But this is not a police brutality case. This is separate from a Breonna Taylor. This is separate from a George Floyd. This is an individual man who they assumed or saw or thought or just felt, because of how he looked and how he was running through their neighborhood and he wasn't familiar to them, that they had the right to pull up on him with cars and with guns.
Just to clarify, the three men, Travis McMichael, Gregory McMichael, and William Bryan, and again, all of whom have been in custody in Georgia since their arrests last May. Sarah Rogerson.
The only thing that I can add is that white privilege is a heck of a drug. And this Women's History Month, we need to think about these issues as intersectional, intertwined, and inseparable. And that's that we, if you are white in this country or white passing, if you hold white privilege, there's zero excuse, you know, time's up on white privilege and time's up on sexual harassment. And if you can't get with the program, you need to get help.
Alan, give you the last word.
The last word is it's terrible. I've talked about American racism again and again and again. And here's the thing, even if they get to a jury, even if, you know, what happens, happens, there's going to be one jerk on that jury who says, under no conditions am I going to vote guilty. That's what you worry about.
Yeah. And how hard it is. Sarah, I did want to ask about the change of venue. Is that A, possible, and B, a good idea?
Yeah, it's pretty exceptional. I don't know the mechanisms in Georgia. You know, it's not unprecedented, but it would be exceptional.
All right. Let us end there. My thanks to everybody for being with us this morning. Many thanks to everyone, of course, who has been with us and who wrote in and participated in the program. We love you very much, and we thank you for that. Alan, thank you so much, as always. Great.
Thanks for your leadership, Joe.
Thank you very much. Right back to you. Jennifer Burns, always good to speak with you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Libby Post, thank you very much. Be well. And Sarah, thank you very much for your insights, as always. A pleasure.
Always a pleasure.